The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Fun, the 4US Network.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Nontario. This is now our third episode. We were supposed to record this on Friday. However, because it being Ontario and BC being a predominant focus, BC was having an election on Saturday. So, you know, there's no point in releasing an episode this week with outdated information. And so today, Aaron and I are going to go over British Columbia's new election results and the new government that they have, the Horgan NDP majority. Aaron, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's very clear that Premier Horgan's gamble worked. He wanted to rid himself of his minority Green partner and take control of the legislature for the NDP on its own, and he has succeeded. The numbers from as of this morning, 55 seats for the NDP, which in a legislature of 87 is a healthy majority, 29 for the BC Liberals, which is a drop of 12, and up one for the Green Party, and that's a big deal for them because it is their first seat off of Vancouver Island. So congratulations to them for gaining a seat, but unfortunately it's a bit of a silver lining on a loss of influence, so a bit of a sour taste in their mouths. But the way I can see it, Premier Horgan wanted a majority, and he got what he was looking for. What's your thoughts, Hafiz?
You know, I think this was a result. If you were in the British Columbia sphere over the last, I'd say, few years, I would say this is a result that we've been expecting for a while. I would say, and I'm not the biggest fan of the NDP, everyone knows that, but I did vote for them the election before because I was upset with Christy Clark. And I think for a lot of people, they achieved a lot of their goals. Now, I wasn't very convinced this time around. I didn't really like the election timing call and everything, especially in the middle of a pandemic. And as I saw it as a little bit of a dirty move on pinning Sonia Fresneau from the Greens down, not giving her a chance to gain momentum. However, she's now in the legislature, and that makes me very happy that we now have more representation from the Green Party. Which I think is a really nice medium between the BC Liberals and the NDP. I also really appreciate where the new Green Party seat is. And it's on Sea to Sky, West Vancouver, which is, I mean, if you think West Vancouver and for, you know, our British Columbia residents, West Vancouver is perhaps one of the richest, most prestigious areas to live in Canada. The British now this is the side of West Vancouver going up to the Sea to Sky Highway, so it's basically everything from West Vancouver to Whistler, which is a different demographic than West Vancouver Capilano, which is more of the British properties people. But these are still usually relatively well-off people. Now, the Squamish Valley is something that's grown over the years, and you've seen a lot more young people in that area. So you can see why something like that would move Green. And, you know, the mentality of people in that area, they're a lot more focused on the nature around them. What are your thoughts, though, on the whole Green Party thing? Do you think this is a growing momentum in Canada?
Well, like we've talked about, Hafiz, in previous episodes, BC has an insurgency culture with respect to its political parties. Parties seem to govern for large stretches of time and then almost hand off power to each other. So Social Credit governed for many years. Then you had the BC NDP in the 90s. Then the Gordon Campbell Liberals swept the board, reducing the NDP down to two seats when Gordon Campbell won his first majority. So he governed for a while, and then Christy Clark took over. And now we have John Horgan. The Green Party is positioning itself very well to provide a potential insurgent for the future. So they went from 2 to 3 this time around, made inroads in Vancouver, could well find themselves in very interesting positions, both up the coast and into the mainland. Similarly, and I'm glad you brought up the geography of some of these ridings, because you're absolutely right. West Vancouver is a very interesting region to start to flip towards environmental issues with the Green Party. If you look up north, if you look in the Peace River riding, Trevor Bolin, the new leader of the BC Conservatives. Now, the BC Conservatives have been going through a reorganizational phase. I call them the spiritual successors to the Social Credit Party. If you look at the mainland, and if you look at the interior of BC, these are ridings that traditionally go conservative on a federal level and reflect conservative values both fiscally and socially. Now, traditionally, that has, or in the recent past, in the last few decades, those voters on a provincial level have looked to the so-called Free Enterprise BC Liberal Party as their voice. But Trevor Bolin, this time around in Peace River North, in the northeastern part of the BC interior, got 35% of the vote for the BC Conservative Party. That's a great base to build on. And if you look through the narrative of the BC Liberals as it flows through some of their strongholds through the interior, some of the BC Conservative candidates that got in the 10% of the votes in their individual ridings, those margins in some cases were enough to flip ridings from the Liberals to the NDP, which contributed to the size of the NDP majority. You look in places like the Fraser Valley, you look in ridings like Landley and Chilliwack. The Conservative Party of BC did quite well in those ridings relative to how they've performed before. So as you say, Hafiz, the Green Party is setting itself up well. If there is going to be another insurgency on the left side against the Horgan NDP in the years to come, it could well come from Sonia Fersendo's Green Party. And if there's an insurgency on the right against the BC Liberals, because let's be honest, the Andrew Wilkinson BC Liberals did not put on a show for the ages. And if there's going to be another party that takes their place on the free enterprise side of things, it's going to be Trevor Bolin's BC Conservatives.
And you know what? They already did cost the BC Liberals a few seats. If we're looking into areas where they lost them in sort of like Langley and whatnot, there were seats like where guys like Ryan Warwa took away a lot of the vote that the BC Liberals could have counted on before. And if you add up their totals,
13% in Langley East, and the margin between the NDP and the Liberals, 39 to 35. Very hard to see how 13% can flip that riding.
You see a lot of that starting to trickle in, especially the closer you get to the Vancouver area, where the BC Conservatives, people who are conservative minded, that may have traditionally voted BC Liberal over the last 16 years, now see themselves as having another option that's more sort of, I'd say, to their brand. It's what really got me was the BC Liberals and the Conservatives, they have almost exactly the same color and you can't really tell their signs apart when I was driving around. And I was like, wait, Ryan Warwa blue, and then the BC Liberal person is also blue. I guess the BC Liberals never wanted to go with the Liberal red, which is, you know, the traditional color. But I think now that there is a Conservative Party in British Columbia that kind of has a little bit more common sense than it had in the past in running a election out here, there's now more to compete against. And that conservative sort of free enterprise vote is not beholden to one party anymore. And I don't think it should be. I think even when it comes to the Greens and the NDP, I see the Green Party as having a little bit more common sense than the NDP sometimes when it comes to fiscal issues, and maybe understanding finance a little bit better. And I think that's going to come out over the next while in the legislature. Now, I think one of the main goals was to make sure that, you know, John Horgan maybe could have blocked Sonia in getting into the legislature. But it looks like she's going to be in there. And, you know, British Columbia politics, usually has little blips of entertainment. I have a feeling it's going to be quite entertaining coming in up in the next 4 years here.
Well, I would say there's going to be two elements of it. One is going to be entertainment, and one is just going to be managerial competence. And I think that the COVID political environment is changing the way campaigns are playing out, because the ideological divide that has historically defined Canadian politics over, I guess, our lifetimes, over the past decades, doesn't really matter in a COVID environment. You're looking for somebody with a steady hand at the tiller, who's got a proper understanding of both geography and economy and also management, and is able to take command in a situation of crisis. And John Horgan went into this election betting that his record would stand up both on its own and against the opposition, and he was proven right. It wasn't at all clear to me that Andrew Wilkinson had anything to offer on the pandemic beyond just a change in brand. And his PST proposal, his proposal for a PST holiday, in the context of both a health crisis and an economic crisis that in my mind is based on consumer confidence rooted in income and growth, a PST holiday is just the wrong policy instrument on both a healthcare and an economic front. So it's not clear to me that there was a sound strategy to the BC Liberals other than playing politics as it's been run before, because that's why you run a PST holiday proposal. It's because you want a saving sticker shock item that'll make voters believe that they're going to get a pocketbook benefit that will make their lives better off. But in the context of the magnitude of the problems we're dealing with right now, that political playbook just doesn't fly anymore. So it'll be very interesting to see how the leadership plays out, how quickly it's going to be before the leadership is replaced, or if that doesn't happen, what argument Andrew Wilkinson is going to make to keep the reins. But going forward, recognizing that the strategy that the BC Liberals tried this time just fell flat, it'll be very interesting to see in a pandemic environment and in an economic recovery environment what the BC Liberals put forward, because it's not entirely clear that the space that Gordon Campbell and Christy Clark was able to carve out for itself as the BC Free and Enterprise Party is going to be there going forward, given the managerial competence is a brand that the NDP has taken over in BC, and given that the free market label is being seized by Trevor Boland and his Conservatives.
You know, I would agree with much of what you said there. In terms of where the BC Liberal Party is now, they have certainly lost a lot of connection with BC voters. There was a time where almost everyone you spoke to obviously we're voting BC Liberal, and it was a sort of a joke to say that you're voting NDP, and it's totally flipped. If you look throughout BC, you're seeing areas where there was a safe BC Liberal seat that's not there anymore. With Andrew Wilkinson, and particularly with COVID, I think you're very right there. It would be interesting to see what would have happened if we were in a similar election without COVID, and someone was, there wouldn't be a reason to offer a PST discount, but what his promises would have been like in sort of a non-COVID election. Now, in response to COVID, and particularly with Andrew Wilkinson, I found it interesting. He's a doctor. He's a medical doctor that, and he touted that sort of in his election platform. However, it didn't link in anywhere. And I think the big issue with Andrew Wilkinson is that he just was not likable. I've met the guy in person. I thought he was a good guy, and I enjoyed my meeting him and having a few moments with him, but I didn't see the charismatic leader that the BC Liberals would need to draw support. And I think that was...
I agree with you. I agree completely. And I think it was exactly the opposite. His personal resume is sparkling. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's a medical doctor. He did quite well in the senior ranks of the BC Public Service before he crossed over to the political side. And as we've talked about on previous episodes, he's done some work with the Federal Liberal Party during the Ignatieff era. Like, this is a man who was accomplished, but it was telling for me in the last week of the election campaign, even in the BC Liberals' ads and promotional materials, you weren't seeing his name and you weren't seeing his face. You were seeing in some moments the policy platforms of the BC Liberals, the PST cut, for example, ICBC, motor insurance issues as well. And you might see attacks on John Horgan, but nowhere by the end, that I could see anyway, were you promoting the leader prima facie, where you're promoting the leader for himself. And that for me, is an avowal of failure. And that's the type of thing you see from political campaigns that kind of know they're in a losing effort. But even beyond the leader himself, even beyond Mr. Wilkinson, you had a number of big name liberals lose their seats this time.
Oh yeah. Big time.
And I'll list some of them out. You got Sam Sullivan, the former mayor of Vancouver. You got Mary Polek, Jas Johal, and of course, Jane Thornwaite, who unfortunately made a name of herself during the campaign for all the wrong reasons. These were powerful.
And Lori Thornis.
Well, I was saying the ones that you kind of want around. Lori Thronis made a name for himself in the same ways he's been making for most of his career, which is promoting social conservative values using indefensible analogies. You got these big name BC liberals that have gone down with the ship. When you've got a political party like that, when I think about what political parties are, there are three fundamentals in my mind. You've got the brand, you've got the policy, and you've got the people. The BC Liberals brand right now is in tatters. The policy didn't stand up to scrutiny, and you've lost big name people. So the question is, are you able to right the ship, or are the losses going to continue to bleed? And if I'm a BC Liberal right now, even just on a membership level, I'm starting to look around and evaluating my option to see, is there a better place for me given my values and given the state of this party?
You know, I think that's a question that quite a few people within the BC Liberal Party are asking themselves right now. Now, I know Jane Thornwaite quite well, and you know, I have worked with her in the past in North Vancouver. I think she is one of those people that was quite instrumental in the BC Liberals in sort of their cohesion. And now that's gone. I see that they've lost quite a few of their sort of big name characters that sort of were the go-to in the party. But I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. It sounds to me as though they need a fresh new look. If I look at sort of where they are now, I'm asking myself as a BC Liberal voter, what would it take to make this party more appealing to the vast majority of British Columbians? Where did they go wrong? And I honestly think it starts going back in their history. The way they ran elections in the 2000s all the way into sort of 2017 has drastically changed. The 16-year period, society does change considerably. And I think the coldness that they showed in the 2000s does not go well with people anymore. I don't think the sort of mindset where you ignore the problems that are going around in your society and focus just on the economy and the people in the top layer of the economy is going to do as well anymore. Now, a lot of British Columbians, especially in the Vancouver area, did very, very well over their time in office. A lot of people hold them accountable for sort of what happened with real estate investments and in the cost of housing, particularly in BC, in Vancouver. When I was in sort of just out of high school, entering college, you could still get an apartment for $500 to almost $900 sometimes just outside of Vancouver. Now that's impossible. However, the wages that people earned have not changed. Rent over here for so almost a studio is almost getting close to $1,800. Now, on the flip side of that, while there's people that can't afford rent, there's an entire generation, mostly of the sort of, you know, my parents' age, that have done phenomenally well. They bought houses in the 90s that were maybe worth under 200,000 that are now worth $1.5 to $2 million. And, you know, across the board, those houses have changed hands to new owners. Not all of them are from BC or Vancouver or even here. And the sort of the foreign investment looked beautiful when it first started. Like, you know, oh, look at this money coming in. Look at our society. We're getting all this cool stuff and new flavors, and we're becoming a hotspot that people know about. But all that goodness that happened within that left back a whole lot of people. And I think this is the reason we are in this situation.
I agree. Hafiz, when I think about the state of rebuilds for a political party after an election, I think about some of the things that were quoted for the Conservative Party when the leadership race started late last year. And I vaguely remember, I think the quote gets assigned Stephen Harper saying it's not the same party anymore. That's the key lesson that political parties need to digest after a loss. They have to ask themselves hard questions about whether the loss results from fixable errors tied to the same playbook or fundamental changes that need to be had on personnel and values. And if I look at the reason why the Gordon Campbell BC Liberal Party adopted the strategies and priorities that it did in the early 2000s, it was a reflection of both the void in the political spectrum that existed at the time and the priorities of BCers as they existed at the time. People are different now than people were 20 years ago. The environment in BC is a universal issue. It's not like it is in some other parts of the country or parts of the world where it's sort of an either or. In BC, owing to the fact that you have such beautiful natural resources, everybody agrees that environmental conservation, stewardship, and forward planning is critical. The question is how to do it. And if I look on the right side of the spectrum, it's not like what you might say in Alberta about resistance to measures. It's about getting the measures right. And if you look at regions like the forestry regions of the interior, you've got an economic interest as well as an environmental issue in getting it right because the resource needs to be sustained for future generations. So those types of priorities need to flow through the policies of any party that wants to be taken seriously in BC, which in my mind is a reflection of the fact that when the BC Liberals campaign on, as I saw in their final ads, PST holidays, police officers, and the ICBC monopoly as their headline issues. If you don't have a headline policy that meaningfully addresses the environmental concerns, you will fall flat with BC voters because it's a necessary part of the platform. So the BC Liberals have to take a hard look at themselves on a policy basis, on a political basis, on a people basis, and put together the coalition that moves forwards rather than replicates or tries to replicate the strategies of the past. Because in my mind, it sounds like in your mind as well, Hafiz, that's just not going to work.
I would say in terms of the environment, the reason, you know, it's not so much of a divisive issue here is because we all like the clean water and living by the forest and, you know, waking up to clean, breathable air that people from around the world say this is absolutely spectacular. Like the drinking water in BC, I just can't get over how lucky we are to have the tap water that we have over here. The water that we get from taps, and in particular where I when I was in North Van, I got the first dibs of water coming right off a glacier reservoir. This is the type of water, you know, companies dream of putting into a bottle and selling around the world, yet we get it as a free resource. And things like that matter to people, no matter what side of the political spectrum you are. It's interesting because conservatives over here in BC see the value of the environment and see the necessity of resource development done in a manner that saves the environment and keeps its sustainability alive. Now, I mean, the BC Liberals were the people that brought in the first carbon tax. The whole concept of carbon and tax being brought together had never occurred in Canada before, till the Gordon Campbell Liberals did that almost now, I think, 10 years ago, I'd say. When that came out, it was like, a carbon tax? What is this thing that we're doing? Well, why is this? This sounds outrageous. Yet they still won the election following that. And, now it's sort of a universal that we all pay. I think there are leaps and bounds ahead. It'd be interesting to see, if sort of what's happening in BC might be able to help the rest of the conservatives out there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. The carbon tax is an especially interesting issue. The Conservative Party of BC campaigned against that this time around, and that reflects the views of the membership. I've actually had conversations with senior members of the Conservative Party of BC over this, because in my mind, the issue when the BC Liberals implemented the carbon tax is that has consequences on the economy. And you're right, Hafiz, that at the federal level, the dialogue about carbon taxes became polarized and poisoned through rhetoric in a way that really isn't productive for anybody. There is a case for a carbon tax and there is a case against a carbon tax. And depending on the outcomes that you're trying to achieve, economic, environmental, and otherwise, you can use that instrument or any other instrument to achieve, or a variety of other instruments to achieve the same objective. The problem with the carbon tax in the way that it was implemented, in my mind, was that the economic consequences were just accepted. And in my mind, that's a no-no. If you're going to implement a carbon tax for environmental reasons, you've got to take coordinated action to protect economic growth. Even Stéphane Dion on the federal level with his classic green shift was doing that. He was proposing reinvestment of carbon tax revenues into corporate tax cuts. So the challenge in my mind, if you're going to accept a carbon tax as an environmental instrument, you've got to coordinate that with measures to support economic growth so that you preserve jobs and economic welfare. If you're not going to do that, then you're going to have a hard time selling the carbon tax in the parts of the province that it has the most impact on, which are the resource sectors, the farming sectors, the manufacturing sector, places where you're actually the one paying the tax. Those are the ones that cry foul, and in many cases for good reasons, because they're the ones that are bearing the brunt of the burden. So in my mind, going forward, it's that balance of environmental protection and economic growth through sound, well-designed strategy that's going to define the party, whether it's the BC Liberals, the Conservative Party of BC, or who knows what else. Whoever carves out the right side of the spectrum is going to be the one that's prioritizing getting the balance right.
I think there's a lot of sort of, it's going to take a lot of work for all these parties that sort of are no longer in contention for leading the province. And also the parties that want to grow to adjust their policies sort of to build that large base across the province. And I mean, if you look at BC, Northern BC is completely different from the south of BC in how they think and sort of, the values that they have and sort of the lives they live. It's two very different lives. The south coastal BC, you know, it's a lot more city living, and in the north, it's all mostly wilderness and not so populous people, and sort of in your Okanagan, you have more sort of your growing area and food basin, but BC, I think, is such a massive if you fit other countries, you could fit some countries into British Columbia. It's a massive, massive province. And to think that, you know, we have sort of a standardized level of need for governance and how that government reacts to our day-to-day issues, it's kind of a bit of a stretch, because someone that's on the coast of BC is going to have a completely different opinion from someone that's bordering Alberta on the Rocky Mountains. One thing I think I'd like to see, though, from the BC Liberals, there's one candidate, Alexa Liu. She was a Liberal candidate for Richmond South Centre. She's an ex-Olympian. I think in terms of how she presented herself after the election, she was one of the few BC Liberals that on Twitter got a lot of positive comments and on the way she congratulated John Horgan. I think she even beat her own leader to congratulating John Horgan. I don't think Wilkinson did that till the next day, until it was brought out that, he's still not called John Horgan. And I think this sort of more compassionate BC Liberal candidate is what British Columbians are actually looking for. And I don't think that sort of the old attitude of this not being a caring person and being sort of this tough, rugged individual is going to go as well in southern BC any longer.
I agree, Hafiz, completely. I think there was a lack of personal connection from the BC Liberals on the leadership side, and my sense of it on a local side too. And you're going to need more people like as you just described, Alexa Liu, who's willing to be more openly conciliatory and congratulatory and engaging. It'll be very interesting to see on the leadership level, assuming Andrew Wilkinson resigns, who the replacements are. And you look at the lists of both inside caucus candidates and outside candidates. There are some big names that are already being floated in terms of stalwarts from earlier BC Liberal eras. And the names that I'm seeing are Kevin Falcon, the former finance minister.
Oh, yeah. Clark. I've heard.
Yeah. And Diane Watts, the former mayor of Surrey, who later became a Conservative MP federally. These are big names on the BC right side who aren't currently part of the BC Liberal caucus. And in the caucus, you'll have to help me with these, Hafiz, because some of these names I'm not as familiar with. But the names I'm seeing are Michael Lee, Todd Stone, and Peter Milibar. Hafiz, I don't know who from your perspective on the ground in BC pops out at you as the big names, but at a minimum, assuming the leadership becomes open, there should be some action.
Those names, they're in the BC sort of political ecosystem, they're not as well known, and unfortunately with the BC Liberals, the Liberal side of the party has not had very much of a voice. They're mostly quieter people within the party, and it's been mainly run by the Conservative side, and I think that Conservative side is going to have to give way to a little bit of sort of the Liberal-minded people, even though, you know, we both know that Andrew Wilkinson worked with the federal Liberals. In terms of the presence and sort of the emotion of it all, was a lot more colder. I think whoever the next leader of the BC Liberals is going to have to relate to everyday people that are working people, people that have to take the SkyTrain to work in the morning, people that have a mortgage and, you know, a couple car payments and have to provide for their kids. And while that might seem like, you know, oh, wait, that's pretty much every generation that we've had, in particular in BC right now, this is where people, I think, feel that they're most hurting is because of what it costs to live over here right now. And I don't think the BC Liberals ever took that very seriously. They were against sort of the empty homes tax. And if you speak to anyone that's probably in their mid-30s and below, they thought that was the most boldest thing that any government has ever done for British Columbians. And sort of bringing affordability into the forefront and making it a real issue, I think has been critical. I think what the NDP were talking about doing with sort of housing for the poor and the homeless and stuff like that connected well with a lot of people. Now, I think they deserve some criticism on how they went about a lot of that, in particularly with addiction counseling and whatnot, not being a main clutch of their solution. However, they were talking about things that traditionally aren't brought up into the political sort of dialogue, because there are issues that historically I think people did not really want to focus on, even though they are urgent to people, like housing affordability. It's not something that we've talked about in over a generation. And I think the fact that right-leaning parties now have to, can't escape this is a big thing, because I think from the right, you're going to have to see some solutions to these issues that people are seeing that will make a difference. And I'm in this stage where I'm like, what could that solution possibly be? What would a solution to sort of the empty homes crisis be from the right that doesn't involve sort of an empty homes tax?
Well, it's almost you're putting me on the spot. If I had an answer to that question, I might be.
I'm trying to get you a
right
job
now.
Here.
You're absolutely right.
In BC, so that you can become a political.
But I'll point it.
Go ahead. Sorry.
But you never know. But I agree completely that issues like affordability, both on housing, on the housing side, whether it's on food affordability, utilities affordability, you're absolutely right that parties like the BC Liberals have to focus on these issues. And it reflects the way the dialogue of public policy changes over time. Now, I do believe that Trevor Boland of the BC Conservatives has this right in terms of understanding how political strategy is evolving over time to prioritize meat and potatoes issues like that rather than broad strokes ideology. And him, if you look at his personal stories as he tells them on the internet and social media, he talks about issues like the opioid crisis, addictions issues, mental health issues, and he gets very personal with this type of thing, talking about family members who've gone through hard times. And he had his own little foible in the middle of the election campaign as a result of a former employee at one of his fast food franchises who told her personal story. And it's almost the manager's worst nightmare, because whenever you're sort of put under the spot on a personal memory from your history, he was very open, saying, "I wish I'd managed that moment differently." I won't get into the full detail. It was a sexual harassment issue, as I recall, one of his employees at a store. And a manager has to deal with that. And he was very honest, saying his response might not have been perfect. And in my mind, that's the right response, and it reflects sincerity. But like I say, issues like addictions, mental health, harm reduction, as you say, Hafiz, it's not, politics is not left-right anymore. And if anything, that's a virtue, because the idea that the same political issue should define ballot box decisions for decades upon decades upon decades, in my mind, is a failure of democracy. The question in my mind is which party identifies the proper set of issues and which party can put together management plans and has the credibility to then implement those plans to actually make the world a better place. So like I say, Hafiz, I don't know that I personally in this moment have an answer for housing affordability any more than I do for mental health care. But I agree with you 100% that the challenge for political aspirants going forward is to present credible plans to solve problems like that.
And I really appreciate your answer on that, because I think from most people in the political spectrum on the right, you still see sort of, you know, with the federal conservatives, they've come to accept a lot of this, but they aren't talking a lot about all of this. Sort of like, yes, we know it's an issue, but we don't really have a solution. And I'm wondering if ideology is a good enough differentiator for a party anymore. Personally, I don't think so. And I don't think it has been for me in particular for the last 14, 15 years. I find that I think most of our ideologies, whether it's conservatism, liberalism, socialism, have sort of a bit of decay to them. They're based on people that were writing at the turn of the Industrial Revolution that have little to do with the world we live in today. Someone in that era of humanity, especially in the lower classes, faced a lot more hardships than someone in the lower classes faces today. However, the things that we face in sort of, you know, the working class over here, there's still economic issues that we face that we would consider unfair in today's eyes, that I don't think have come out as much from conservative parties. And I'm wondering if there's going to be a shift in these parties into being something more than just the traditional conservatives. And I wonder what that's going to look like, and if Canada is going to sort of be a leading think tank for that.
Well, that's exactly, over the past 20 years, over my adult lifetime, playing in circles on the right, as you all know I do, that's been a constant sort of attention about intellectual depth and about broadening the scope of attention of political parties on the right side of the spectrum. So it's not just tax cuts, and it's not just the same old narratives that we hear time after time. So we can actually get into the details, whether it be on environmental policy, or whether it be on healthcare, immigration, on social cohesion, even language issues. The right side of the spectrum is very well aware. I can even phrase it using partisan dialogues. Like, you talk about the claims that people make about the universities being dominated by the left. I don't want to go there in a sort of esoteric sense, but it is true that historically, depth of thought on the right side of the spectrum has from time to time been lacking. Preston Manning took it upon himself. The Manning Center that he set up in Alberta was a specific response to this. At Carleton University, the political management program has some inspiration. Some of the cast of characters behind the scenes developed that. It's across the partisan spectrum, but the motivations from an individual perspective was individuals wanting to identify leaders of thought on the right. So, like I say, there are institutions that have been created in response to this. There are certainly media outlets, and we can question them. We know the True North Media is rising in prominence on social media. Let's just not go there.
Let's not go there. Yeah.
But it's an illustration of the attention the players on the right side of the spectrum are paying towards deepening their knowledge base, the depth of discussion, the depth of proposals, and this is going to have to continue both in BC as well as across the country.
I think that's a really positive message you've put on that, though, because that, I think, as for me, as someone that's more of a centrist voter, thinking of a conservative party that maybe looking across the other side of the spectrum and seeing that these issues are actually real and matter, speaks to me as something as giving me an option in the future. Now, one other thought I was having was, how does this election in BC influence what's happening in Alberta, our province right next door, that, you know, has a leader like Rachel Notley? Now, historically, John Horgan did throw Rachel Notley underneath the bus over the pipeline issue, which I thought was absolutely ridiculous and completely the wrong political move at the time, because guess what? No one's talking about the pipeline anymore. It's happening. It's going through. But now there is no NDP in Alberta. I'm wondering if a party like the NDP on a provincial level needs more of a national strategy so that they could win a province like Alberta back. And what do you think that looks like for an Alberta that's also changing demographically, much in the same way BC has, with people moving out of sort of traditionally conservative areas and more centrist-minded people moving in?
Well, in my mind, John Horgan has now firmly established himself as voice number one for the NDP on the national stage. Like, he has just decisively won a majority in one of the largest provinces, and he has done it on the basis of his personal record and his personal competence. So if he chooses to help Rachel Notley or not. That is his call to make. It was the political calculus that he made, as you alluded to, Hafiz, in his first mandate, reflected the political environment that he was in. Two things in my mind change. One, as I say, he is now in a greater position of strength, and he may wish to share that strength for the good of other provinces and the good of the country, which, if it works, will pay back to him. Stephen Harper would like to use the line, the longer I'm prime minister, the longer I will be prime minister. For John Horgan, if he helps the NDP take back power in Alberta, if he's able to contribute to that, that helps him. The other side of the coin is that it's quite clear that Rachel Notley needs John Horgan. So the question in my mind also flips to say, how is Rachel Notley in terms of the platform that she's going to present against Jason Kenney next time around? How does that help BC? And as you say, Hafiz, the pipeline in particular, if John Horgan can just say the pipeline is happening, deal with it, that's not the best issue for Rachel Notley to take on, because you're kind of campaigning against a brick wall. So
she wouldn't campaign against the pipeline, though. She was for the pipeline. He was against it. And it was funny.
In my mind, she was trying to play it both ways in some ways. She was for the pipelines existing, but she was stalling it. So you can try to play that line. She was able to eke out one election win on the base of it. Good luck to her if she tries to do it again. But as I say, the bottom line for me, Hafiz, is one, it'll be a question of whether John Horgan is willing to use some of the political capital he has gained to help a potential provincial and ideological ally. And the other side of it is Rachel Notley, looking at the strength that John Horgan is in now, how is she going to incorporate that into her policy agenda?
That's actually a really good question, and sort of what I was going to go through next. What do you think Rachel Notley can learn from John Horgan in winning over voters on the right?
Well, I don't think, in my mind, there's a lot of lessons that she can learn, because John Horgan had the incumbency advantage, and had the incumbency advantage in a crisis environment that he responded to well. The comparison in my mind is to the Rachel Notley that went into her reelection campaign as Jason Kenney, in which the ballot question in my mind, the referendum on her performance, didn't go in her favor. In my mind, Rachel Notley did show managerial competence as Alberta Premier, but she did it true to her values. In terms of tax increases, in terms of spending, in terms of union relations, and she was judged on that. So she has a choice this time around. She can either run against Kenney, and that'll be very interesting if she chooses that strategy. She will run on her record from last time. She can run on a record from last time around. That, in my mind, has shown itself to be a weak strategy. Maybe she can do it better. Who knows? Or she can run on something different. And that's not really something we can speculate about. But if she does run on something different, that will necessarily be different from what John Horgan has just done, because he has run an incumbency campaign and he has run it well. So like I say, in my mind, there's not, despite the brand connection, there's not a lot of lessons to be learned. I don't know if you think differently, Hafiz.
I think that she could learn a couple lessons on sort of reaching out to that centrist voter that maybe sort of over the whole ideological gambit to begin with. I think if I'm looking at what's happening in Alberta, Jason Kenney hasn't sort of gotten much of what he's wanted to do. And it's more so still playing a game of pointing fingers. And I think Alberta needs, from what I see, is a solution that looks at sort of a positive outlook for the future of Albertans and people in Alberta. And I think much the same way that the NDP in BC dropped a lot of their more sort of left-leaning stuff that people don't really want to talk about. Yeah, they're much more pro-union and whatnot, but they didn't stand on that as much this time around. I think that that's going to be a huge step forward for them in Alberta. And I'd like to see in Alberta where maybe even the Liberal Party over there takes a few notes and says, hey, you know, we can maybe play a spoiler for one of these parties over here and pick up a few more seats. I think the way politics are playing out across Canada, these parties that were sort of classically divided by, you know, their banner and their ideology are going to have to face a new reality that we're all waking up to, where ideology doesn't matter as much anymore. And I that's a reality I think I live in, you live in, and a lot of people that are in the voting area live in today. And
the standard for that is, of course, Quebec. Quebec went through this renewal process. The Coalition Avenir Québec, under the leadership of François Legault, did not exist when I was a child. It was a flow through. It started with Mario Dumont, the Action Démocratique du Québec, which took up the right side of the spectrum during the 90s and the 2000s, when the dominant parties were the Parti Québécois and the Quebec Liberal Party. The Action Démocratique du Québec started with one seat, and it was Mario Dumont in Rivière-du-Loup, and it is now the Coalition Avenir Québec governing the province with a healthy majority, right-leaning, nationalist in a sense of cultural independence, but not supporting Quebec independence. François Legault was a cabinet minister in the Parti Québécois governments of the 2000s, but he rescinded his support for Quebec sovereignty as a near-term objective, and he has embraced the place of Quebec in the language of the Harper government as a nation within a united Canada. So that reflects an evolution of party loyalties and brand loyalties in Quebec that has played out over the better part of 20 years. And you're right, Hafiz, whether it be in BC, whether it be in Alberta, or in a number of other provinces, the brands that we have come to know and the institutions that we have come to know may well change. Like you suggest, the Alberta Liberal Party, Hafiz, some of the cast of characters of the Alberta Liberal Party have deep roots, like Nasheed Nenshi. I don't know which party he identifies with, but some of his supporters have ties to the Alberta Liberal Party. Stephen Carter is a name that I remember prominently, and he has some ties across federal and provincial parties. The question is whether the institutions that some of these people tie their personal brands to can develop political followings on a meaningful level. And it's not clear that some of the people that we've seen in the past, that some of the brands that we've seen in the past are the ones that we're going to see tomorrow. So whether it's the Conservative Party of BC and BC, whether it's new names like the United Conservative Party of Jason Kenney, like we assume for the sake of historical narrative that this is the natural successor to the Klein and Stelmach conservative side of the spectrum. But there are some, especially at the grassroots level, that will take issue with that, because those who put their time, sweat, tears, and money into the Wild Rose Party can take credit for the things that Jason Kenney is doing. So as I say, and as you say, Hafiz, there is transformation that is ahead, both on a policy level and on a party brand level, and I will say it's healthy.
Well, Aaron, I think we both agree on that. And what wonderful times to be alive in this era of humanity, of such great change and hope and positivity. And, you know, I think this is a good step forward for British Columbia in where the election has gone. And I look forward to seeing how we change as Canadians in terms of our political parties and the ones we support. This has been a really, really enjoyable episode, I think, to chat about this election result with you. And I'd like to thank everyone listening. This is Hafiz Noorani and Aaron Seal on behalf of FU Politics at the Sox Network over here. And we appreciate you listening to us and giving us the time of day to get into your heads a little bit. Thank you very much.